The Toyota was still under the bridge. It was tucked in, with its passenger side close to the thick brick pillars that must have supported the structure for the last 100 years. Reacher pulled across so the bug was tied up against its driver's side, making it the meat in a sandwich. He pulled the t-shirt away from his face. The driver stared at him. She looked surprised for a moment, then suspicious. Reacher gestured for her to roll down her window. "How are you guys holding up?" Reacher flashed what he hoped was a friendly smile. "Surveillance duty can be pretty dull, can't it? That's why I've brought you something. Should liven things up." Reacher removed the lid, stretched his arm across the driver's lap, and tipped the contents of the cup all over the Toyota's center console. Then he wound up his own window and sat for a moment and watched as curly fingers of thin green smoke began to rise and twist inside the other car. High school chemistry. He'd remembered it pretty well. The four occupants squealed and clawed at their eyes, then scrabbled for their door handles. The doors on the opposite side slammed into the brick pillars, leaving a gap too narrow to escape through. The doors on Reacher's side were snagged against the bug's running board. Reacher held his position for another moment, then pulled away. In his mirror, he saw the first pair tumble out. Then the second pair followed, stumbling around with their arms stretched out, like horror movie zombies. Reacher felt like he was getting a peek into the future when he arrived back at Mitch's apartment. Rutherford was stooped, hunched. He dragged his feet along the floor as he walked. His eyes seemed dim and unfocused, as if he'd aged 50 years in the course of the evening. "Have you been drinking?" Reacher said. Rutherford didn't reply. "Where's Sarah?" Reacher said.
"Bathroom."
Rutherford made it as far as the couch and slumped down. "How did you do?"
"We have some good news," Rutherford said. "Some okay news, and some absolutely catastrophic news. Which do you want first?"
"Start with the good." Rutherford gestured toward the kitchen. A large gray laptop was sitting on the countertop, connected to an outlet by a twisted, grubby wire.
"We got that."
"A computer?" Reacher said.
"Not just any computer."
A hint of defiance crept into Rutherford's voice. "The computer the asshole town lawyers wanted me to pay $14,000 to see."
"Which leads to the okay news. I at least have a future as a cat burglar ahead of me if I can't get my job back. We got in, we got out. No one had a clue we were ever there."
"And the server things?"
"That's the bad news. They're gone.
We looked everywhere. Not even the broken glass from the cabinet door was left." "But we're not giving up, are we, Rusty?" Sarah emerged from a door to the side of the kitchen. Her hair was wrapped in a towel, and she was wearing a black satin robe that was several sizes too big for her.
"We're going to find those damn things, starting tomorrow. We'll search the whole state, the whole country if we have to. They must be somewhere."
"What do they look like?" Reacher said. "Could you describe them to me?"
"I can get you pictures if you like," Rutherford said. "Model numbers, serial numbers."
"Why?" "You should let me find them. You and Sarah should leave town."
"No way."
Rutherford crossed his arms.
"We've been over this before."
"We should find the servers, then leave." Sands sat on the couch next to Rutherford.
"They're portable. We can work on them anywhere. There's nothing to be gained by staying in harm's way longer than we have to."
"You should leave now," Reacher said. "Someone wants these things badly enough to send 6 guys after you. Those 6 failed. Do you think they'll give up?"
"No.
They'll send 12 guys, 18, who knows how many. And if they get their hands on you, how far do you think 'I don't know where the servers are' will get you?" Sands adjusted the towel on her head. Rutherford said nothing.
"You should leave," Reacher said. "If I can find the servers, I'll get them to the FBI. They can do whatever they need to with this digital fingerprint you think is in one of them. Then when it's safe, if you want to, you can come back."
"No." Rutherford shook his head. "I don't care how many people they send. I'm not being driven out of my home. And I'm not handing the servers over to anyone. Not yet. Not if there's a chance we could develop Cerberus into something that's worth serious money. I don't want to sound shallow or greedy, but
Look at this place. Mitch is 10 years younger than me. He had one good idea. I've worked my ass off all my life. I deserve my shot. That's fair. Sands tucked a loose strand of hair back under the towel. You do deserve a shot. You should benefit if Cerberus turns into a success. We both should. But you can't benefit if you're dead. So don't look at it as being driven away. Think of it as a sabbatical. If Reacher finds the servers, we could give a copy to the FBI. Have them sign some kind of agreement not to develop any products out of what they find. That's not what they do anyway. And in the meantime, we could do more work with the models. At my place. It's safe there. And imagine what it would be like driving back here in a brand new Rolls-Royce. Your old boss pleading with you to come back. You telling him where to stick his job. An electronic chime sounded in the kitchen, and Rutherford stood up. That's my computer. It's finished its updates. Finally. Let's see. His phone rang. He checked the screen. It's a local number. I don't recognize it. Should I answer? It's your phone, Reacher said. Rutherford pressed a key and held the phone to his ear. Hello? He listened for a moment, then passed the phone to Reacher. It's Officer Rule. She wants to talk to you. This is Reacher. He stood and walked to the window. We need to talk, Officer Rule said. I'll give you an address. Come alone. The garage will open. Drive in and stay in your car. Reacher found the address Officer Rule gave him without any problem. It was a small single-family home with a neat but plain yard on a neat but plain street in a sleepy neighborhood half a mile from the courthouse. The blacktop had been resurfaced within the last year, judging by the color and the lack of severe cracking. But Reacher thought it was strange that there were no sidewalks. The street butted right up to people's properties, to their lawns or driveways or beds full of medium-sized shrubs. Reacher wondered if that was down to the heat or the humidity, or if people in that town were particularly averse to any form of exercise that involved leaving their own yards. The correct house was easy to spot because it had a police cruiser parked outside along with a late-model Honda Civic. Reacher guessed that would be Officer Rule's personal vehicle. He slowed as he approached, checked his mirrors a final time to be sure no one was following, then turned onto the driveway. The garage door immediately began to clang and clank its way up, and when it was all the way open, Reacher rolled inside. He killed his engine, and the door began its descent. There was an aluminum ladder fixed on the wall on one side, and a bicycle suspended by its front wheel from the other. There was a stout shelf covered with gardening fertilizers and weed killers and tools of various kinds. Reacher had no idea what any of them were for. Once the door to the driveway was all the way down, a personnel door opened on Reacher's left, and Officer Rule stepped through. She was wearing navy sweatpants with a matching t-shirt. Her hair was held back by a gold clip, and she was holding a slim envelope. Reacher opened his door and started to get out, but she shook her head and gestured for him to stay put. We've got to be quick. My neighbor will be home any minute, and I don't want her to see you leaving. You think she's spying on you? You've never lived in a small town, have you? A smile spread briefly across her face. Of course she's spying. Everyone is. Maybe not the way you were thinking, but I still want nothing to do with it. Here. She passed the envelope to Reacher. This is for you. What is it? He said. There was nothing written on it. Nothing printed. No label. A file. A copy, anyway. For the journalist you were asking about. Why are you giving it to me? Because I'm sick and tired of it. What happened to her is horrible, and no one in the department is doing anything about it. You were a military cop. You showed good instincts with Holly's scumbag boyfriend. Maybe you can shake something loose. Get some justice for this woman. Her name was Toni Garza. I've never even heard Detective Goodyear say it out loud. The photographs of the dead journalist were safely tucked inside the envelope, and the envelope was safely tucked beneath the floor mat on the passenger side of Marty's car. There was always the chance of a random traffic stop, and Reacher didn't want to fall foul of a cop with prying eyes if he got pulled over. But even though the pictures were hidden, the images continued to cycle through Reacher's head as he drove. His having seen them made no difference to Tony Garza. She was still dead. It did make a difference to Reacher, though. He had to assume that whoever had killed Garza was the person chasing Rutherford, or part of the same organization, at least. And now that he'd seen the level of brutality involved, there was no way he could leave Rutherford alone. Sands opened the door to Mitch's apartment when Reacher knocked. She dried her hair and styled it and had changed into yoga pants and a loose pale blue silk shirt. "Everything okay?" she asked. "What did this Officer Rule person want with you?" "She had some information for me, on the QT, a kind of cop-to-ex-cop thing, related to a case I'd asked her about at the station house earlier." "Is it helpful, this information?" "Helpful's not the word I'd use, but it does add perspective." Rutherford was in the kitchen, tethered to his computer. Apparently, it was showing its age by refusing to operate unless it was attached to an outlet. "Is that thing working?" Reacher said. "I need you to find the email Tony Garza sent you. The journalist." Rutherford rattled some keys and prodded a square pad, and after a minute, he gestured for Reacher to come closer. "Here it is." Rutherford pointed at the screen. "Like I said, she was inquiring about a particular address. No mention of an owner's name." "What about her second message?" Reacher said. Rutherford shook his head. "That was a voicemail. I deleted it as soon as I listened to it." "Do you have the address of the property?" Reacher said. "Is it still standing? If someone lives there, I want to pay him a visit. Or her. First thing in the morning." "We have to track down the servers in the morning," Sands said. "Let's see what I can find," Rutherford said. "Give me 2 minutes." He pressed and prodded and called up maps and databases, then nodded. "Oh, yes. It's still standing. It's actually famous. Or notorious. I've never seen the street address before. I only know it by its local name. The Spy House. 2 Soviet secret agents lived there, back in the 1950s. Now it's owned by a businessman, Henry Klosterman." Chapter 15. There were 2 bedrooms in Mitch's apartment, and 2 other occupants that night alongside Reacher. Although Reacher felt that describing the sleeping areas as bedrooms was going a little far, they had no doors, no windows, no walls to speak of. The only things separating them from the rest of the apartment were the wooden dividers, and they only came up to Reacher's chin. He knew without looking that the beds would be too short, so he figured his best bet was to let Sands and Rutherford use them. He could sleep on the couch. He'd have to forego his usual practice of pressing his clothes under the mattress, but it would be better from a security perspective. If anyone found out where they were billeted, he would be the first one they came to if they got through the door. Reacher woke himself at 7 a.m., He could hear slow, peaceful breathing, plus the occasional grunt and snort from the other side of the dividers. So he lay still for another half hour and ran a few of his favorite guitar riffs through his head. Then he got up, coaxed Mitch's complicated coffee machine into action, and while it gurgled and hissed, he took a shower. He emerged from the bathroom 14 minutes later, still unshaved and with his hair still damp, and found Sands perched on a stool at the kitchen counter. She was wrapped in the same robe as the day before and was sipping coffee from a plain white mug. She stood when she saw Reacher and poured a mug for him, and then poured another as Rutherford stumbled out from behind the dividers, rubbing his eyes. Sands was in favor of calling ahead to set up an appointment at the spy house. She felt it was the polite thing to do, and also the practical thing. They could make sure someone was home, avoid the risk of a wasted journey, and the risk that the sight of Reacher arriving unannounced could lead a panicked homeowner to call the police. Reacher didn't agree. Experience told him that surprise was his friend. He'd prefer to be knocking on the door at 4 a.m., the way the KGB had done back in the day. And if no one was home, all would not be lost. It's easier to search a house when the owners aren't there. Rutherford was still too dopey to voice a coherent argument either way, so they decided that Reacher would go unannounced and Sands would stay at the apartment and find out what the town did with its discarded computer equipment. She was clinging to the hope that they could find the servers Rutherford had trashed and keep the dream of making their fortune alive. Reacher drained one more mug of coffee, then stood up to leave. "Wait." Rutherford slid down from his stool. "I'll come with you. Give me 2 minutes to get dressed." "You don't want to stay and help Sarah?" Reacher said. Rutherford shook his head. "There's no point. No one would talk to me. Sarah's far more persuasive anyway. And I always wanted to see inside the spy house." "Why?" "It's not going to be full of spies in disguises practicing secret codes with invisible ink. It'll just be a normal house."
"I know. I still want to see it."
Reacher sat back down and drank another mug of coffee while Rutherford rustled and rummaged behind the divider. He returned wearing the same pants as the day before and the same kind of polo shirt, only in a different color. Reacher stood and picked up the key to Marty's car.
"You know what?" Rutherford said. "Why don't we take my car?"
Reacher smiled to himself. "I get it now. You don't want to see the spy house at all. You just want to find out if I brought your bug back in one piece."
"Can you blame me?" Rutherford said. "I love that car. It's irreplaceable."
In the garage, Reacher waited for Rutherford to walk around the bug and inspect every inch of paintwork. Then he got down on his knees on the passenger side and peered underneath.
"What are you doing?" Rutherford said. "Did you drive over something? Tell me you didn't hit a deer."
"I'm looking for tracking devices," Reacher said. "You do your side, underneath the car, along the running boards, inside the fenders, anywhere a magnet could stick."
"But you checked yesterday. You found a tracker. You said you ditched it."
"I was in the Army for 13 years, Rusty. We check, and then we check again. It's what we do." Rutherford shrugged and then worked his way from the front to the back. He came up empty-handed.
"Nothing on my side. You find anything?"
Reacher leaned across the hood and held out his hand. "Another tracker. The same kind. In the same place." And there was this. He showed Rutherford a scrap of paper. It was held in place by the magnet. Rutherford took the paper and read it out loud. "Romeo, Juliet. A bunch of numbers. 8 bells.
"What does it mean?"
"Romeo Juliet is RJ in the NATO phonetic alphabet. My initials, military style. Reacher, Jack."
"I get it," Rutherford said.
"And the numbers? They could be a grid reference. What about 8 bells? "That's noon in Navy time."
"Maybe someone wants you to go to this place at noon?
But why write it like that? To show they know my background? To gain my trust? Or intrigue me, perhaps?"
"What if it's a trap? You shouldn't go."
"Have you got your phone? Can you figure out where this place is?" Rutherford tapped his screen, then made some swiping and pinching movements.
"Reacher, don't go."
"Why not?"
"I know about this place. It's an old factory, just outside town. It's been abandoned for years."
"Growing up, we heard all kinds of rumors. No one who went in was ever seen again. I never dared go."
The spy house was hidden behind a wall. The wall was built of stone, 8 feet high, and topped with broken glass. The driveway was blocked by a gate, made of iron, also 8 feet high, the kind that slides to the side so there are no hinges, no join in the center either, no weak spots at all. This particular one was plain, no nonsense, no ornamentation, just thick vertical bars. It reminded Reacher of a grate covering a giant drain or a sewer. You'd need a tank to knock it down. The bars were too close together for anyone but a child to squeeze through. Not a welcoming proposition. And there was a sign mounted at eye level to complete the effect. It read, "No photographs, no trespassing, no interviews without an appointment." Rutherford pointed to the sign.
"Maybe Sarah was right. Maybe we should have called ahead."
Then he wound down his window and pressed a call button on a keypad set on a pole. "Yes?" A woman's voice answered after half a minute.
It was quiet and cold like a whisper from a tomb. "Good morning. My name's Rusty Rutherford. Is Mr. Klosterman available?"
"Can you read, Mr. Rutherford?"
"Yes."
"Do you have an appointment?"
"No."
"Then you should already know that Mr. Klosterman is not available."
Reacher leaned toward the open window. "Actually, we don't know that. Your sign says you need an appointment for an interview. We're not here for an interview, so we don't need an appointment."
There was a pause.
"Then what are you here for?"
"There are no maintenance visits scheduled for today."
"We're following up on something that will be of interest to Mr. Klosterman. Considerable interest. To do with some correspondence from a journalist. About property records for his house."
"Please wait."
A faint electronic buzz told them they hadn't been disconnected. Then after 3 minutes, the woman's voice returned.
"Mr. Klosterman will see you. When the gate opens, drive directly to the front of the house."
Beyond the gate, the site was divided by a line of mature trees, cypresses and sycamores. The area to the left of them was rough, unfinished. There were no structures, and no plants taller than stalks of coarse, scrubby grass. The house was to the right. It had an attached two-car garage. Next to that was a covered porch. It was raised up on a stone base and plain white pillars stretched up to support its roof. The rest of the building was finished with wood siding, long horizontal strips, painted olive green. There were 4 windows on the first floor, 4 on the second. Each had shutters. All were open, pinned back against the wall, finished in a darker shade of green. The roof was covered in cream-colored shingles. A chimney extended 6 feet above the ridge on the far left. Rutherford followed the driveway toward the garage, then pulled into a parking area in front of the house and killed the engine. Reacher climbed out. Rutherford followed him, and together they climbed the 3 steps and crossed the porch. Reacher rapped on the door. A woman answered. She was in her late 20s, wearing a knee-length black dress with a white apron. Her blonde hair was tied up in a bun. She was thin, almost malnourished, but she moved with effortless grace, like a ballerina.
"Please come in," she said.
Hers was the voice they'd heard on the intercom. Quiet and cold. There was no question about that.
"Can I offer you gentlemen some refreshment? Iced tea?"
They declined, and the woman led the way along a narrow hallway. There was tile on the floor. Family portraits on the walls. 4 doors, a pair on each side. Plain, pale wood. No panels. Narrow architraves. The woman paused outside the second door on the right, knocked, then opened it and stood aside to let Rutherford and Reacher enter. She didn't follow. There was one person already in the room. A man, slim, rangy, with a mane of white hair. Like Einstein if he'd worked in a bank, Reacher thought. He looked about 70, probably born around the time the house was built. Maybe born right there in the house. The man put down his newspaper, hauled himself out of his armchair, and offered his hand.
"Mr. Rutherford, I'm Henry Klosterman. It's a pleasure to meet you. I know you by reputation, of course, and I don't envy the position you're in. I've done work for the town in the past. I'm essentially retired now, but I make sure my company doesn't even bid for municipal contracts anymore. The penny-pinching, the endless finger-pointing, it drove me up the wall. Made it impossible to do a job properly. I can only imagine what it was like to work there permanently. And your friend?"
"Reacher." Reacher didn't offer his hand. "Jack, I'm Mr. Rutherford's life coach."
"Really?" Klosterman said. "How interesting. Now please, gentlemen, take a seat."
Klosterman lowered himself into his chair. Rutherford perched on the edge of a couch with thin tweed cushions and a slender wood frame. Reacher joined him, hoping it would take his weight.
"Now that you're here, how can we help each other?" Klosterman said.
"Well," Rutherford said, "as you can imagine, I have some time on my hands right now. I'm trying to put it to good use, following up on things that fell by the wayside when I was working around the clock after the computer system was attacked. One of them is an email. Actually, an email and a voicemail. I received them from a journalist. She was asking about property records to do with your home. Klosterman steepled his fingers.
The journalist.
That would be Tony Garza, I presume. You heard she was killed.
Such a tragedy.
We heard. Rutherford paused. It sounds awful, what happened.
It was. Tony was such a lovely girl. She had so much talent. So much integrity.
You knew her?
Of course I knew her. She was working for me.
In fact, it was me who suggested she should contact you. I was hoping you could help with some research she was doing. To do with your home? Reacher said. It's unusual history?
Goodness, no.
Klosterman frowned.
There's no need. What little there is of that stupid story has been done to death.
Living in a nest of Cold War spies. That sounds like a great story. If the problem is you're tired of telling it, why not have someone write a book about it? A journalist would be an obvious choice, especially one with talent and integrity.
It wouldn't be a book. More like a haiku. There's not enough material.
And this place was hardly a nest. There were only two of them. They were brothers. They only owned the place for 18 months. And they didn't even do any spying while they lived here. They wrote a textbook on math. I wish that was the angle the public latched onto. Imagine if this place was known as the Math House. Then I wouldn't be swamped with tourists every time a new Bond movie comes out. If not your house, what was she researching?
Parts of my family history. My father fled to the States from Germany in the 1930s. He could see the way things were going politically. And somehow, of all the places in the world, he settled here in Tennessee. He founded a business, started a family, did all kinds of things. But the details of his early years in the States are sketchy. I felt it was time to find out as much as I could and record it before it was too late. Where he lived before he moved here. When exactly he bought this house. I think someone else owned it between him and the spies, but I'd like to be sure. I want as much detail as I can get, including the human aspect, you know. There's a story that when he bought his first house, he had no money and credit was hard to come by. So he used a painting he brought with him from Germany to back the purchase. These are the little quirks that are so easily lost. I want to know all of them. I want my son to know. And his son, if he ever has one.
That sounds like a wholesome family project, Reacher said. But it's not the kind of thing anyone should get killed over. Are you sure there's not more to it? Buried treasure? The location of the lost ark? Klosterman's face was blank.
Someone was killed over my project? Who?
Tony Garza.
No. That's crazy.
Why would her death have anything to do with my project?
Tony was a hard worker. She was driven. She wasn't working for me exclusively. She had a dozen projects on the go. Some she got paid for, like mine. Others she was doing off her own bat. She was digging into all sorts of unsavory things. She dreamed of becoming an investigative reporter for one of the big papers, although that was always unrealistic. There are so few of those left now.
What kind of unsavory things? Did she tell you?
Not chapter and verse. But Tony did confide some things. She wanted to root out crime and corruption. I think she saw me as a kind of father figure. She looked to me for advice from time to time. I warned her to be careful. More than once.
This seems like a nice town. Is crime and corruption a big problem here?
No. But she was based out of Nashville. She did most of her work there.
How did you find her if she's not local?
I came across her name online. She was recommended by someone on an ancestry forum.
Are you going to replace her? Or had she finished her work?
I guess I will have to replace her. I haven't had the stomach for it yet. Tony had completed the broad outline, but there's plenty left to do. The biggest problem is confirming all the dates.
That's why she wanted access to the town's records, and why she contacted you, Mr. Rutherford. I can see why you would want access, Rutherford said, but not why Tony reached out to me. Why did she think I could get my hands on the papers you need? I was the IT manager, not the archivist. As far as I understand, it worked like this, Klosterman said. Tony was in touch with the archivist. There was a project running to digitize all the records. The archivist told Tony there'd been a kind of false start. The computer memory thing they tried to use was too small, so halfway through the process, they raised some extra money and got a bigger one. They copied everything. Then you, as the IT manager, took the old one into storage until it was needed for something else. So it's possible the records I want are still on it. Rutherford thought for a moment. I know the equipment you're talking about. I did take it. I thought it might be useful for something else. Do you know where it is now? Not exactly, but I'm trying to find it. I need it for something. If you do find it, would you let me see if my father's records are there? I'm not sure if I could, Rutherford said. It's town property. I'm not sure if we're talking about 70-year-old documents, Klosterman said. Maybe older. Whose confidence could possibly get betrayed? And it's all theoretically public domain stuff anyway. It was in the physical archive before the fire. So come on. What do you say? Rutherford didn't reply. I can make it worth your while if compensation is an issue, Klosterman said. Very much worth your while if I can get the first look. Patience is not a virtue of mine, and I'm not getting any younger. Rutherford squirmed on the edge of the cushion. It's not about time is the issue, Reacher said. Rusty has a lot to do to prepare for the next chapter in his life, and as I'm sure you know, an IT manager's time is expensive. How expensive? Klosterman said. $10,000 should cover it. Cash. Klosterman struggled to his feet and held out his hand. You're a life coach, you say, Mr. Reacher. I'm beginning to think I might need one of those myself. How long to find the records? That's hard to predict. We're working on it. I'll let you know. Reacher walked back to the car in silence. His gut was telling him that he'd met Klosterman before. In barracks rooms, bars, jail cells, offices, back streets, all kinds of places, all over the world. Or that he'd met guys just like Klosterman anyway. Guys with something to hide, but who imagined they're smart enough to think on their feet, to cover their trails. Reacher didn't think every word Klosterman had spoken was a lie. His father's immigration, for example, his businesses. There were too many things that would be easy to check on, and only a fool would be dishonest about details that could be disproved in a matter of seconds. It was the family history aspect that didn't pass the smell test. Writing it for his son, tying it up in a pretty bow. No, it was more likely that there was some kind of skeleton in the family closet. Something illegal, something embarrassing, something Klosterman wanted to bury or spin. Something worth $10,000 just to see a record of. But a sack of cash was one thing. Was it also worth Tony Garza's life? Was it worth Rutherford's? Chapter 16. There were two people at the kitchen counter in Mitch's apartment alongside Reacher, and they were both mad at him.
I can't believe you offered to sell the server. Both of Rutherford's hands were clenched into fists. You had no right. It's not yours. We don't know where it is. And 10 measly grand? Cerberus will be worth 100 times that much. 1,000 times. I can't believe you would even think of going. Sands threw the slip of paper onto the countertop. It's a trap. It's obvious. How can it not be?
Reacher took a mouthful of coffee. Okay. First of all, Rusty, don't worry. I have no intention of selling your computer thing. And Sarah, yes, it's almost certainly a trap. But sometimes the only way to know if the stove is hot is to touch it. Sands glared at him,
Someone smart told me that once, he said. You're obviously not smart if you're even considering walking into a trap.
I never said I was smart. Stubborn, maybe. Obstinate, even. On occasion.
Why offer to sell if you had no intention? Rutherford said. Are you going to rip Klosterman off? We can't do that. I have to live here. My reputation's tattered enough already.
We're not ripping anyone off, Reacher said. It was a test. To get a sense of how important these records are to him. Or sensitive. Or embarrassing. I named a big number and he didn't turn a hair. That tells us something. And here's another reason. Say Klosterman isn't what he seems to be. Say he's somehow behind Garza's murder and the attempt to kidnap you. Do you want him thinking you're not willing to play ball? This way, his incentive is to keep us alive.
If you care so much about being free and healthy, why would you knowingly walk into an ambush? Sans said. Are you crazy?
Not in the slightest, Reacher said, and I'm not going to walk into anything. The best way to defeat an ambush is to be there first, which I will be. But logistics aren't the most important thing. You're focusing in the wrong place. Look at the note.
Sans picked up the scrap of paper. She reread it slowly and checked the other side.
What?
I don't see anything.
The first two words. What do they mean?
Romeo Juliet. R.J. Reacher Jack. Your name.
Exactly. Someone made it personal. I'm not some faceless guy who got in the way anymore. They're coming after me specifically. They need to understand that's the wrong thing to do.
Reacher parked Marty's car half a mile south of the mousetrap factory and covered the rest of the ground on foot. He moved slowly. He stopped frequently, but never at the same interval. He never continued until he was certain no one was following. And no one was watching. The clock in his head said 10:45, 75 minutes before he was due at the rendezvous. More time would have been better, but experience told him 75 minutes would be enough. 9 times out of 10. The moment the abandoned building came into view, Reacher knew that no kind of ghost story could have kept him away when he was growing up, or his brother Joe. There were too many iron girders to climb, too many nooks and alcoves to hide in, too many frontal assaults and insane last stands and against-the-odds escapes to stage, and too much prime real estate to fight over with the other kids. Plus ça change, as his mother used to say. The more things change. The moment Reacher stepped through the gap where the tall wooden door used to be, he knew 75 minutes weren't enough. Not this time. He'd hit the 1 in 10. The ambushers were already there. He couldn't see them, yet, or hear them, or smell them. But he knew. Eyes were on him. He could feel them. He could feel a chill on his neck. Some kind of primal response to being watched. A warning mechanism hardwired into his lizard brain, as finely tuned as his ancestors had been millions of years ago. Then, forests. Now, a factory. Either way, evading predators. Not getting eaten. Not getting shot. Living to fight another day. Plus ça change. Reacher kept moving. Same speed. Same direction. He didn't want whoever was watching to know he was aware of their presence. Not until he knew exactly where they were. And how many there were. He strained his ears. Heard nothing. Scanned the rubble and the weeds covering the ground, checked the long line of smashed windows, the gaping holes in the roof, looking for movement, shadow, shape, shine. He saw nothing. Reacher took another step. Something made a sound behind him, metal shifting against stone. But not someone looking to shoot him. They could have done that already. A decoy? Reacher scanned the ground in front, behind, both sides. He increased the radius, looking for signs of disturbance, a place for someone to hide, to spring out of when his attention was drawn away, to get in close, quickly, and neutralize his advantage in strength and size. He saw nothing.
It's just you and me, Major. It was a woman's voice, behind him, calm and confident.
and there's no need to worry. No need to do anything either of us will regret in the morning. I just want to talk.
Reacher turned around. The woman he'd last seen driving the Toyota was standing next to a sheet of corrugated iron against the wall. She must have eased her way out from behind it. She was dressed all in black with a small tactical backpack slung over one shoulder and her hair tied back in a ponytail. There was a gun in her hand, a Glock 19. Reacher approved of her choice. It was compact, easy to conceal, and reliable. The chances of a misfire were slim to none. Her hand seemed steady. He was a sizable target. They were 15 feet apart. If he rushed her, she would have 15 chances to hit him, assuming the magazine was full. 16, if she had one already in the chamber. More than one chance per foot. Not odds Reacher liked. I've never been much of a conversationalist, he said. Then just listen. I know a lot about you. Enough to believe I can trust you. I need to even those scales, and I need to do it quickly. So I'm going to tell you one story from my past. My father was a Stanford man. He wanted me to follow in his footsteps, but I had other ideas. I wanted to study in England, so I applied to college there, one of the old ones. It doesn't matter which. But because I was foreign, I had to jump through a couple extra hoops. One was writing a special essay. There was no word limit, no time limit, and no choice of subject. The title they gave me was, What is a Risk? You know what I wrote?
Reacher said nothing.
4 words. This is a risk. It worked. I got in. And I wasn't lying. It was a risk. The biggest one I'd taken at that time. Now I'm going to take a bigger one. The biggest I've ever taken. She slipped the backpack off her shoulder and lobbed it under arms straight at Reacher. It landed at his feet and kicked a small cloud of dust up over his shoes. Pick it up, she said. Open it. The pack was made of black ballistic nylon. It wasn't new. One of the shoulder straps was starting to fray and the bottom corners were scuffed. A tried and tested piece of equipment, the best kind. It had a small pocket on the right-hand side, an identical pocket on the left. Both were empty. There was a triple row of molly webbing across the front with nothing attached, and one internal compartment. Reacher unzipped it and looked inside. There were 3 spare magazines for the Glock, a set of car keys. For the Toyota, Reacher assumed, a hairbrush with 2 elastic ponytail holders wrapped around the handle, and a book. See the Bible? She said. Take it out. Reacher set the pack down and fished out the book. It was a King James hardcover edition. It had a dark red cardboard front, a dark red cardboard back, gold printing on the front, gold printing on the spine. It was scuffed and worn, as if she carried it everywhere. The leaves were yellow and dark, as if the victim of some spillage long ago. Maybe some kind of fruit drink. Certainly something sticky, because the pages were gummed up solid. Go ahead, she said. Dig your fingernails in. Pull. It will open. I don't need to. Reacher slipped the book back into the pack. I've seen one just like it before. You're with the FBI? Special Agent Fisher, she said. Margaret, you can call me Mags, if you help me. What kind of help do you need? The same kind Tony Garza gave you? Did you know enough to trust her, too? And did she trust you in return? Who's Tony Garza?
Reacher said nothing.
I'm serious, Fisher said. I don't know who Tony Garza is. I have an entirely different problem. Tony Garza was a journalist. She's dead. Murdered by the people you're working for. In a very nasty way.
I can believe that, Fisher said after a moment. I'm working for some very nasty people. But I didn't kill her. My cell didn't kill her. I don't know anything about her. But I do know this. If you don't help me, more people like her will get hurt, maybe murdered. Also, in a very nasty way.
Reacher said nothing. The cell I've infiltrated was sent here to bag someone named Rusty Rutherford. But I guess you know that since you stumbled into the op and royally screwed it up. I'm not helping you capture Rutherford, even if you convince me about Garza.
Fisher held up her hand. I'm not asking you to. All I need from you is information. Rutherford was to be taken because he has something a certain foreign power is desperate to get its hands on. He either has this thing in his possession, or he knows where it is. If I can get to it first, before they go after Rutherford again, that's the best way to keep him out of further danger. Which foreign power are we talking about? I can't say. If you want my help, you're going to have to turn your cards all the way up. Fisher sighed. Russia. Okay. And what is the thing they want? I don't know. Not exactly. All the cell was told is that it's an item, an object, something physical. It contains data or records of some kind, so it could be a paper file or a photograph. But I think it's most likely to be computer-related, given the job Rutherford just lost. What kind of records? I don't know exactly. Something that reveals a name or an identity, or that would enable us to deduce one. Of an agent? Fisher nodded. Theirs or ours? Theirs. An active agent? Very active. And that's a situation that needs to be corrected. Why is there an agent in a sleepy town like this? Fisher shook her head. The information is here, not the agent. He's somewhere else. Or she. Where? Repeat a word of this and I'll kill you. I'll probably have to kill myself, too. Have you heard of the Oak Ridge National Laboratory? Near Knoxville, where they develop the supercomputers? They do many things there. Supercomputing is one of them. Another is cybersecurity. The United States is facing a lot of threats. We have a lot of defensive programs running. And the Russians have an agent in place who's attempting to steal a copy of the most critical one. Its official name is Project C02WW06BHH21. Snappy name. Only the geeks call it that. Everyone else calls it the Sentinel. What does it do? It protects the integrity of the election system software in 48 states. It's the only thing that does. Why not all 50? Politics. I haven't got time to go into it. And the Russians are trying to steal a copy. So what? If they succeed, what could they do with it? Change the result of an election? Aren't there fail-safes? Paper backups? In some places. But changing the result is not their goal. That's too direct. This is the Russians we're talking about. You've got to understand just how long a game these people play. Their philosophy is, if you hit a man with a fire hose, he goes down, but he can get up again. If you gather enough raindrops and use them in the right way, you wind up with the Grand Canyon. They're trying to carve gaps in society that are too big to bridge. It's all part of a bigger campaign, to sow discord and division. It's been running for years. On social media, conspiracy theories, attempts to undermine the mainstream media. Fake news. I've heard about that. This time they're specifically trying to erode faith in the election system itself. We know they're serious. They already had a dry run 4 years ago in Kentucky. What happened was, on election day, they sent out a phishing email. You know what that is? No idea, Reacher said. It's an email that looks legitimate, like it's from some official trusted source, like a bank or an insurance company. People trust banks and insurance companies? Some do. Anyway, the messages look genuine, and they generally have a subject that sounds tempting in some way, or urgent, like half-price car insurance if you apply within 12 hours. So gullible people open these messages and something bad happens, like an old-school letter bomb. Right. Opening the message, or following a link, or downloading an attachment, one way or another it infects the computer. A malicious program gets in and gains access to your files and passwords, and if you're on a network, it gets into that too. In the Kentucky case, the Russians sent an email to all the election officials purporting to be from the VP of technical support at the company that supplied the election software. The subject line said it contained a critical update to the operating instructions. I can see how people could fall for that. They shouldn't. They're specifically trained not to. But trained or not, the email went to 200 people. 6 of them opened it.
So the Russians got access?
Yes.
What did they do?
Nothing. That time. They were proving the concept, laying the foundations, building up to a wider-scale attack this year. Imagine the scenes on election day if every person who shows up to vote at the correct precinct is told they've been re-registered without their knowledge at some other precinct on the other side of town. Or that their registration's been canceled altogether. Or when the results are announced, it turns out that in some marginal districts, Mickey Mouse and Daffy Duck are registered. Or that a bunch of people are registered in multiple precincts, even if they didn't know it at the time or act on it. There'd be chaos. Total chaos. Only the Sentinel can stop it. It didn't stop their dry run. It didn't exist then. That's why it was developed.
Are you sure it works? This is the Russians we're talking about. Maybe they've already penetrated some local elections and are just pretending they want to steal it to make you think they're frightened of it.
Fisher shook her head. No. We know the Sentinel works. It's already stopped 12 attempts in 6 different states. Plus, we have a source who's confirmed the Russians don't believe they can defeat it. They weren't too worried, because they have an agent in place to steal it. Then panic set in, because a record of some kind surfaced here that could lead to his exposure.
I heard the town archive burned down.
It did. The Russians did that. They're also behind the ransomware attack that cost Rutherford his job. Evidently, they wanted to shut down the new digital archive before it could go online.
The town's going to pay to get it unlocked. It had insurance. Why not wait until it's up and running again and go through it with a fine-tooth comb?
The town might pay, but that archive is never going to see the light of day. I guarantee you that. Not all of it, anyway. Not the part we need.
Rutherford figured out that some system he built might have captured the identity of whoever ran the ransomware attack. He thought that's what someone wanted to get from him.
Not possible. We know it was the Russians. The Russians know we know. And they want us to know, honestly. Every successful attack is them giving us the finger.
I spoke to a guy yesterday at the courthouse. He said he was an agent with Homeland Security, infrastructure protection. He had a theory that Rutherford had colluded with the attacker.
Agent Walwork. He's my partner. Sorry for the deception. We were hoping Rutherford might have somehow revealed what the item is, or where it is. No. The panic's about whatever can unmask their agent. That's definite.
In that case, how much do you know about a guy named Henry Klosterman?
Who lives at the so-called spy house? Don't even think of going there. It's such an obvious coincidence, but we checked it out anyway. Those original guys from the 50s weren't KGB agents. Just misguided citizens giving secrets to people they thought were their friends. They did some serious damage when they were in Los Alamos, but nothing at all while they were here. They moved on after 2 years and defected soon after because they felt the noose beginning to close. They're both dead now. They never married. They had no illegitimate offspring. No cousins, no other family that we know of, and they weren't members of any parties or groups that might be looking to carry on their work.
So there's no connection to Klosterman other than the address?
No, none.
Why?
I met with him this morning. I think he's looking for the same thing you are.
You know what the thing is?
Possibly.
A computer thing, a server. It has a preliminary copy of part of the town archive on it.
Jesus Christ. Why didn't you say so before?
I didn't know about the agent and the Sentinel before. Klosterman said he wanted it for a different reason.
What reason?
Some family tree project, he claimed. It didn't quite ring true. I think he's trying to hide something.
How does he know about this server?
He said he hired Tony Garza, the journalist who was murdered, to dig up some property records going back to when his father immigrated. She found out that when the town started putting the archive on the computer, they were using this server. It turned out to be too small, so they switched it for a larger one, and Rutherford, as IT manager, took it back into stock for some future use. When did Garza start working for Klosterman?
I don't know exactly.
But before the archive burned down?
Yes. She started searching the paper records, then was going to use the online archive, then contacted Rutherford as some kind of Hail Mary, hoping he still had the server.
This is finally starting to make sense. She must have found something in the records, realized the significance and tried to report it, or just mentioned it to the wrong person without even knowing its importance.
Or the Russians could have had some kind of tripwire in place, something to alert them if anyone was close to finding whatever they wanted to keep hidden. They're not reckless. They'd know that one document sitting unnoticed amongst how many? Thousands? Millions? In a dusty old archive would attract less attention than a fire.
Either way, Rutherford needs to hand over that server, like yesterday.
That's a logical request, but it's impossible.
Why?
Rutherford doesn't know where the server is. Fisher turned and slammed her palm against the wall.
Damn! Are you sure?
Reacher nodded. He already tried to get it back.
How did Klosterman account for his project getting someone killed?
He claimed Garza wasn't working for him exclusively, said she had a bunch of projects on the go, blamed her death on some hoodlums from Nashville that she'd been sniffing around.
But you didn't believe him.
I'm not saying he killed her. I'm not saying he's working for the Russians. But I know when someone's hiding something.
I'll have my people take another look at him. The organization is so compartmentalized, you could be married to the local Russian contact and not know it.
I get that.
And Rutherford? Not knowing where the server is? Are you sure he's telling the truth?
I am. It turns out he used the server for some other project, and
tell me he didn't wipe it.
No, he didn't. Don't worry. Before the ransomware attack, he pressed the town to buy a backup system for all the computers. They wouldn't come up with the cash, so he tried to build one of his own out of spare parts. It was supposed to overwrite whatever was on the server, but that didn't happen. That's how he knew it had failed. He was so mad about it, he threw all the equipment in the trash.
He's got to get it back.
He's trying.
Why? To give it to Klosterman?
No. He thinks the server can help with another thing he's working on. He wants it back for himself.
Can you help him find it?
Can't you? With all the resources of the Bureau?
No.
Fisher shook her head.
If the Russians latch onto a bunch of federal agents searching the local trash heaps, they'll know where to look. We have to keep this under the radar. Give it another couple of days, please.
What difference will a couple of days make? The election is weeks away. Rutherford can find the server on his own and figure out a way to get a copy to you. He's a smart guy.
It's not that simple. For a start,